Let's open up our Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 11, where we'll start at verse number 6 in just a moment. Last time we entered into the second half of David's 40-year reign. Unfortunately, we also came into his very dark years, where David committed adultery at Jerusalem while his army was besieging the capital city of the Ammonites, a place that back then was called Rabbah or Rabbot Ammon, which just meant the big city of Ammon or the big city of the Ammonites. Today, that city is known as Ammon, Jordan. So you can find it on modern day maps and know exactly where this fight was taking place. But David committed adultery, and now that the woman is pregnant, David is trying his best to cover it up. Her husband, one of David's 30 sub-commanders, one of the top commanders in his army, was serving with the Israeli besieging forces at Rabbah. And so David tries to make it look like the pregnancy has happened because of a visit by Uriah the Hittite to Bathsheba, his wife, when he's running information back to the capital city from the besieged army. So this is how it happened. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 6. So David sent word to Joab, the commander of the Israeli forces, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to David, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. So he covers this all up in military information gathering. He has one of his top 30 guys come back from the front and fill him in with firsthand accounts of how things are going. Then he offers the man the chance for a little downtime. Verse number 8. Then David said to Uriah, "Go to your house, wash your feet," which is just another way of saying, why don't you go back to your own house, sleep in your own bed with your own wife, and just relax while you're here in the capital city, and then you can head back to the front. So Uriah went out of the king's house, so out of the palace, and there followed him a present from the king. Now, what that was about, we don't know 100% certain, but it's probably just David's way of kind of greasing the wheels here to make sure that Uriah feels comfortable with being back at home. But it doesn't happen. Verse number 9. Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. Now we know that Uriah's residence is within looking distance of the palace because David saw Bathsheba taking a bath on the top of Uriah's house from the top of the palace. But Uriah, as we will hear from his own lips in a moment, feels completely uncomfortable with the idea of enjoying the comforts of home, including marital relationships, when the rest of his comrades are besieging a foreign city. So he stays in the dormitory area of the palace, which apparently is near the gateway into the palace. And he sleeps there with some of the on-duty or on-call members of the palace staff. Verse number 10. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" So David, the next morning, has an meeting with Uriah again. He says, hey, you're back from the front. How come you didn't go and sleep in your own bed and be with your wife? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths. Now that's a reference to temporary housing, shelter. The Ark of the Covenant right now is somewhere in the palace compound, and it's underneath a tent. So that's the reference to the Ark. But the Israeli army and the Judean army are all in their little tent cities around the city of Rabbah. So he says, the Ark and Israel and Judah dwell in booths or tents. My lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. So he is a man of principle. He says, as long as they are on duty and having to be away from their families, I am not going to take advantage of my situation to enjoy something they don't have. So I'll be staying in the dormitory again tonight before I head back to the front, because apparently David was delaying him. Well, David said to Uriah, remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that night, or that day, and the next. David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank so that he made him drunk. So this is the second way that David tries to cover up his sin. Now he purposefully tries to get Uriah drunk so that he will maybe act outside of his principles. Now, the custom of the ancient world was that you watered down your wine so that you could enjoy the taste of it, is presumably the reason, so that you enjoy the taste of it for a lot longer period of time. But it would appear that David is slipping to Uriah heavy-duty wine, or possibly even spiking it a little bit with a stronger alcoholic beverage, and gets him completely drunk, and then encourages him to go home. But what does Uriah do? In the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. So even when he has been tricked into getting drunk, Uriah maintains his principle of, as long as my comrades in arms cannot enjoy the company of their wife, I'm not going to enjoy the company of my wife. I will sleep in the dormitory. Which now brings us to David's lethal solution to covering up his sin. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And this is horribly sinful, this whole thing. But we should not be hesitant to say that. In the letter, he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. Now, I do not know what Joab would have made of this. As I've talked about before, Joab is not the best of characters. And he now sees David act in a self-centered way to bring about the death in war of one of his commanders. Now, Joab is going to go along with it. That should tell you something about Joab. But it tells you much more about how David has abandoned momentarily his status as a man after God's own heart. So verse 16, as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. So they're besieging the city, But part of the besieging is to make sure there's no breakouts, that there are no groups that get outside the city barriers and get supplies. So Joab picks a specific place that he knows is going to be likely to bring a fight with a lot of heavy-duty warriors from the other side. So he sticks Uriah in the middle of that. The men of the city came out and they fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Now, we don't know whether or not that Joab did what David had said, which was get him in trouble fighting and then pull back away from him and leave him in a lose-lose situation. But somehow Uriah is dead. Verse 18, then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting. He instructed the messenger, when you finish telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises, and if he says to you, why did you go so near the city to fight? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal? This is another one of those places where they take the ancient name, that is the scribes, take the ancient name and get rid of the word Baal, which back at that time was a reference to the true and living God. It was just a Canaanite word for master or Lord. So Jerubbaal was the name of Gideon. But here they substitute Besheth, which means shame. So anyway, who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal or Gideon? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebez? And you probably remember that. The son of Gideon was a very bad guy. He's the first tyrant of the Israeli people. And he was trying to burn down this tower at Thebez when a woman up the top threw an upper millstone over the top of the parapet, and it landed right on his head and cracked his skull open, and he ended up dying from the injury. Actually, he asked to be killed by one of his servants, but he was on the way out anyway. So we have here Joab anticipating that David, a military guy from his early teens, is going to criticize Joab for taking risks and ending up losing people, because that's what's being reported in the casualty reports. So this is the way that Joab is going to dig at David to remind him, I know what you did, bud. I know that you're the one that made me lose these people, including Uriah. So again, the imagination of what David might say. Why did you go so near the wall? And then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So Joab is clearly wanting to get a dig in at David through the way that he structured this report. All right, let's see how it's delivered. Verse 22, so the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had set him to tell. The messenger said to David, the men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field. So there was a breakout. But we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. And then the archers shot at your servants from the wall. And some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So it doesn't seem like the messenger gives David a chance to object to having come into arrow range of the archers. Instead, he just blurts it all out, including one of your top 30 guys is dead, Uriah. Verse 25, David pays no attention to any of the other report, any of the other casualty figures. All he's interested in is that Uriah is now dead, so he can go to the next part of his plan to cover up his sin, or he thinks. Verse 25, David said to the messenger, "Thus shall you say to Joab, do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it." And then encourage him. So David is like, well, deaths happen in war. Keep fighting. Get the city captured. And then we go on to the plan. Verse 26. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. Now, the typical mourning period associated with the burial, the funeral, was about 7 days. And then the grieving period for more prominent people seems to have been about 30 days. We don't know what the traditional thinking was about a widow remarrying after the death of her husband. But my guess is that sometime between a week and a month is when this next part happened. Because David needs to be married to this woman well before her pregnancy starts being generally known. Now, given the fact that she has missed one of her periods, we know that she's already in her second month of the baby's 9-month period. And so it could be that the wedding is going to take place somewhere in the tail end of the first trimester of her pregnancy. And so the goal that they have in mind is to try to pass this baby off as an early delivery. That is, she gets pregnant by David immediately after their wedding ceremony. Oh, but the baby arrived early. That's what the plan is. Now, it's ridiculous. It reminds me of that traditional phrase, "Be sure your sins will find you out." David is desperately trying to cover up the fact that he slept with the wife of Uriah. But plenty of people have already been found in the loop, and others are going to suspect exactly what we know from the inspired word, that he cheated with Bathsheba. So when the mourning was over, that is the period of mourning, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased he who is. So she has now become one of several wives that David has in the palace. We've already talked about this before, that this is one of those areas that David was already fudging on that he shouldn't have been. But the bigger problem is that he committed adultery and then covered it up by arranging for the husband to die in battle. And so God is not happy. Now the question always comes up in this study. Why didn't God execute David? Why didn't God strike him dead or come up with a plan for the Israelis to convict him of adultery and execute him themselves? And I do not have a clear-cut Bible answer for you on that. It would be on the list of many things that I would like clarification on one of these days when I'm in the presence of the Lord. But by then, it'll just be academic. But I would suggest to you this as a possibility. And that is twofold. God often allows things to play out according to the free will, often sinful free will of all of us humans. And that he typically refrains from intervening except when it is necessary to preserve his essential work. This would go into that Romans 8:28 principle that God is able to make all things work together for good to those who love him, to those who are the called according to his purposes. So God can work with the free will choices of everyone, even the most stupid and hurtful things. He can still bring something good out of it. But I suspect that from time to time, he has to intervene in order to make that window of opportunity real. And so, in this case, it seems to me allowing David to live was the most reasonable avenue of ensuring future success of God's essential plan. That is, there needed to be this line of David yet to be born come into the world to accomplish the plan. Let me share this with you. We know for a fact that Solomon's younger brother, Nathan, who is not going to be born until after David and Bathsheba have been married for several years, because that's where Nathan comes from. Nathan will be the gene line through which Mary comes, and therefore through which the human body of Jesus comes. And Solomon's gene line will be the gene line from which Joseph comes. And because of that, also the gene line through which James and Jude, the half-brothers of Jesus and authors of two of the New Testament writings, come. So it's possible that God, looking ahead and looking through the complex future choices, decided that David needed to be the exception to the rule of execution for adultery. That's all I can offer to you. If you've got some other suggestions, I'd be interested in hearing. But here's how God dealt with David to bring him to repentance. 2 Samuel chapter 12. He who is sent Nathan to David. Now this is Nathan the prophet, who had told David, yes, go ahead, God would bless you in building a temple, even though God had to bring him back on that. This Nathan is probably the Nathan after whom the third son of David and Bathsheba is named. The very one that I mentioned just a moment ago, who was the ancestor of Mary and therefore of Jesus. So he who is sent Nathan the prophet to David, he came to him and said to him. Now what he does is he comes into David with a community decision. Much of David's time was used in making declarations of how the law was to be applied to certain situations. The ideal was that most everything was resolved at lower cases, lower courts. But they would make their way up through the difficult ones, up through the different levels, until finally David would be consulted on them. So Nathan basically pretends that he's got one of these complicated decisions that David needs to weigh in on. So listen to his construction. There were two men in a certain city The one was rich, the other poor. The rich man had many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he'd bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children, and it used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. So he constructs this idea. You've got this poor man working hard every day, and he buys a little bitty baby lamb, a little girl lamb, and he raises her not to eat, but as a pet. And he even sleeps with her. Even when she's grown up, she sleeps with him and eats out of his cereal bowl and drinks out of his cup with him. And his kids love her. And he loves her. In fact, she is one of the family. She's like one of his children. And all of us that have pets, we understand that emotion that's involved there. Now, listen to the rest of the story. There came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So here's the rich man. He's got all the money that would be able to buy a lamb dinner for his visitor. But instead, he sends one of his servants next door to grab the pet and butcher it and serve it. And it has the expected emotional reaction from David. Verse 5, David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, "As he who is lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he's going to restore that lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity." And tomorrow we'll come back with the rest of this story from God's Word.